This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station. Night School on BFM 89.9.
Hi, I'm Sharad Kutan, and welcome to the show that walks you through some fundamental concepts in the social sciences and humanities. Together with Ahmad Fuad Rahman, the show tries to reveal how various thinkers have grappled with theories and concepts to best understand how society works. Each week, Fuad or I will lead a discussion on a concept or a classic text we hope will shed light on the world around you. This week, Fuad, we are talking about cultural relativism. And you're leading a discussion. Do we have a text to deal with this week?
No, I think we're just going to go through an overview of the discourse, what cultural relativism is and what the latent problems are and how, if at all, we can try to overcome those problems.
You do have a reference work, though, that might be useful to somebody who can pick it up. Maybe we'll put it out on Facebook. And what is that text?
It's a small book called The Elements of Moral Philosophy by James Rachels. It's a book I used when I taught ethics in the States. And it has a really interesting chapter there. In fact, it's the second chapter of the book called The Challenge of Cultural Relativism, where Rachels goes through some of the key arguments for cultural relativism and against. And
so it's just like a primer.
Just a primer.
Right? So would you have chosen a different book if you were teaching that in Malaysia?
I don't think so, because I think this is general enough.
So it's kind of as universal value? As universal value.
This is universal enough. And that's what makes it interesting, right? Because it's a perennial problem that we encounter, you know, context, because especially in a globalized world, when we're shifting context, we always have to question ourselves if the assumptions that we bring into our entry into a different context than we are usually familiar with can simply transfer. We can just take it for granted as true at all places, right? So given that this is the reality that even we as Malaysians are living in, it's a good occasion to reflect on what's relative and what's not. This is a good book, too, because it's pretty standard across ethics classes in America. And when I was, before I was teaching ethics, my supervisor suggested for me to do cultural relativism as the first class of the semester, just so that we can get it, sort of get it clarified, you know, because the default position of most people, and especially if you're an undergrad in university, is to be a relativist in a way. And as we're going to talk about soon, this is not necessarily a bad thing. There are a lot of virtues of taking the relative standpoint as your point of departure for evaluating moral issues.
And it seems relatively sophisticated to be a relativist, isn't it?
Because you're sophisticated.
Yeah, because you're kind of saying, well, it really depends on the context, and you
Correct.
Have to describe that context
Correct.
All the time, place, blah, blah, blah.
Although most people don't go that far, right? Most people are just willing to say, all right, let's agree to disagree. Or, all right, who's to say what's right or wrong?
So it becomes a kind of a question of the individual and their choice.
Correct.
So it's relative to you.
Exactly.
If it's good for you, it's good. If it's good for me or not good for me, then it is.
Exactly.
So that kind of relativism is rather shallow, I guess.
It's shallow, and I think it's not as interesting. It's kind of boring, too, if that's the answer to everything, right? So especially if you're in a college context, you're 18, you're 19, you're exploring the world, this is kind of a plausible account of things, right? Because you want to be as open to different things as possible. So when we taught ethics, we were always advised to just deal with this from day one, clarify what the issues are, and even if the students want to be relativists later, they can be more sophisticated relativists rather than just sort of the crude, you know, it's up to you what you want to do, it's up to you how you want to define happiness, or who's to say, right? So we want to try, if you want to be relativist, there are good ways to be relativist and there are bad ways to be relativist, and hopefully we can kind of touch on the difference today.
Do we have a working definition of cultural relativism? Does it differ from other forms of relativism?
Yes. Well, let me just give you the working definition and I'll explain how it differs. The working definition is that cultural relativism is the idea that different cultures have different sets of moral values, and therefore there's no such thing as a universal or objective morality. So this is a relativism that points to culture as the key definition of morality, right? So it is not, on one hand, it can be individualistic, which is sort of the default mode of relativism, usually. But in the case of cultural relativism, the appeal or the account of moral differences rests on cultural differences. So culture becomes a basis for us to say that something is morally different, right? So the statement usually says there is no universal right or wrong because each culture will have a different way of thinking about right and wrong.
So, okay, so we're actually going to have a discussion about the question of morality and ethics related to the notion of cultural relativism. But because, you know, for somebody who's like me who studied anthropology, when we talk about cultural relativism, we talk about a whole range of other things, including things like personhood, notions of personhood that might differ from culture to culture, or even things that we take for granted, like color. Color does, in fact, within a certain matrix, you know, within certain limits, there are, in fact, cultural determinants of how you see the world and what you would describe as a red, for instance.
Yeah, beauty is a good example of that.
Absolutely.
How beauty's value across different cultures.
Right. Yeah. So kinship, you know, how notions of family, notions of how people are related and what constitutes close relations or distant relations or relations that are problematic differ from culture to culture. Mm-hmm. But we're not talking about those notions of cultural relativism, are we? Or are they implied, actually, in some ways, in a discussion of ethics and morality?
I think the latter is more so the case. They are implied, but the discourse of moral philosophy, the focus is usually on practices. So common example would be female genital cutting. That's always a typical example to illustrate the problem, right?
But isn't it too easy? Is it too extreme? Or is that a good thing when you're talking moral philosophy? You take an extreme example and it makes everything so clear.
Well, I don't know. It's not always so clear. I think, and the clarity is divided. In a sense, some people feel that it's clearly wrong, or some people say that it's clearly tolerable, given the differences in culture. And it's a good trope for the discussion because it's so provocative as an example that it's hard to be indifferent about it. And I think, granted, too, when I was teaching in the States, you know, it's a preoccupation among white anthropologists, more so than non-white anthropologists, as it has turned out, you know, because somehow the question of female genital cutting
Or mutilation, as they call it.
Mutilation. Yeah. Although people are preferring cutting now because
Is there a change in the vocabulary which we explain these things?
And largely due to change in sensitivity as well.
So cutting would be more neutral?
Supposedly.
Because mutilation is necessarily bad. It has a negative connotation outright. Cutting is kind of like just technical.
I think so, presumably. And I think, the fact that there is that shift in terminology too signals the sensitivity of the discussion, you know. So
in a class that you had, how would you even begin getting into the question of cultural relativism vis-a-vis the question of morality or ethics?
Well, one good example would be disciplining children. And this is, I guess, you know, with some leverage, this analogy would work, right? In a sense that it is common among white Anglo-Americans that you simply do not physically discipline your children. You try to talk to them, try to negotiate with them, you try to get them to understand the moral lesson behind a certain prohibition. And that's not so the case among immigrant families, where some level of physical discipline is allowed, right? So that's sort of a good gateway to the discussion without having to get into more complicated examples about more sensitive practices. So that's just personally the route I take. And I think it's something that is more relatable to my students then, rather than FGC, which is more controversial.
What's FGC?
Female genital cutting.
Oh, sorry.
That was not my intention to bring
now,
this up.
Now it's an acronym as well.
Oh, it is an acronym as well. You'll find that.
In the literature.
In the literature, yeah. So that was my personal thing. I mean, there are many other examples, like cremation, whether you cremate a body or you bury the corpse, right? So that's... even cuisine is an interesting example. Whether or not eating dogs and cats is a moral problem, right?
Right. So one man's pet is another person's, mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm, filet mignon.
Exactly. That's a good way of putting it, yeah. So these are kind of issues that cultural relativism would like to try to solve, right? It would try to relieve us from having to think about the complications that will arise when we think about these things.
I want to throw in something on that example of the how we deal with children, mm-hmm. because it seems that's also related not just to, okay, maybe state sanctions now against physical abuse by parents and stuff like that, but also to notions of personhood. Mm-hmm. What is a child? You know, is a child just a small adult, or is a child a special kind of person? Mm-hmm. And if you look at, say, the Batak Negrito community in Malaysia, the Temiya, there are notions of personhood that actually, in many ways, has the same consequence as liberal thinking Westerners might have.
So the kids are seen as individuals in their own right?
Absolutely. In fact, your notion of personhood is radically egalitarian in some of our Orang Asli communities in the peninsula. So much so that, you know, this is an anthropologist, my teacher, who told me that a parent couldn't force their children to take medicine. Now,
it's fascinating.
It's fascinating because we assume that we can force a child to take medication because we're doing it in their interest.
Could it be largely to do with the absence of private property in these non-modern communities, right? Where in a modern era, children are seen as the property of the parents. Therefore, the parents have more leeway on what they want to do with the kids. Could that possibly be
That wasn't the explanation. It really had to do... There were issues related to also the consequences of imposing your will on somebody else. And those consequences were somewhat magical in character. I mean, the kinds of things that I think exist in the worldview of some of these communities suggest forms of consciousness that we don't share with them. You know, so the idea of imposing your will, even if it's for the good. But I just want to throw that in because sometimes we, and this might come up again, we make these distinctions between Western values and Asian values. And that's another problematic binary that's often deployed in these discussions about cult relativism. Mm-hmm. So maybe we could begin with why does it appeal to your young student, American student, and generally, what is the appeal of cultural relativism?
Yeah, and I think you're right to say that the appeal is general, because I think we've all come across that moment or that impulse where we adopt a relativist, culturally relativist position. And the main, I guess, one common sensible account would be to say that cultural relativism is, in a way, a sign of an open mind, right? Because it's not dogmatic, because you want to try to be as inclusive and as accommodating to differences as possible. So as an impulse, it has that, how would you say, liberalizing potential. So that's one reason for its appeal. The second appeal is that it's a good expression of how we can mean well. We can try to give something or a practice that is foreign to us the benefit of the doubt. And in that, we withhold judgment or we suspend a critical attitude towards it and just sort of let it happen, right? And all this stems from basic impressions we have about differences, right? Different cultures just have radically different forms of expressions. They have radically different forms of music, of fashion, radically different forms of cuisines. So why not radically different sets of values, right? So given that differences are apparent, given that differences are never going to go away, why not just embrace them and make thinking a lot less complicated? So those are the common reasons behind the appeal for cultural relativism, at least the three that I can think of right now.
That was Fuad Rahmat talking about cultural relativism. I'm Sharad Kutin, and this is Night School. We'll be back very soon on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, this is Night School, and I'm Sharad Kutin with Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, and we're talking about cultural relativism this week. So, and Fuad, in the first part, we ended with talking about the general appeal of cultural relativism. What more can we say about that appeal? I mean, what about its appeal in, say, multicultural societies or its appeal in the encounter between, say, colonial powers and the other in, you know, many parts of the world that were being colonized? How did they kind of like think through cultural difference in that historic period? period? How do we think about cultural difference in this period?
Well, that's a big question. Well, colonialism, I think, is one reason why people would prefer the cultural relativist position, right? Because if you look at the high period of European colonization, it coincided with the universalizing of their economic system, and with that, their missionary project, and with that, their values. And this clearly had very, very painful and disastrous consequences for much of the global South. So, and oftentimes, too, when we have discussions about cultural relativism, the horrors of European imperialism, or even Japanese imperialism more recently, is always the immediate example for why people would prefer the cultural relativist position rather than a simplified universalist take on ethics, right? So, and the presumption is that, and this we can question this, the presumption is that being a relativist will cause less harm to people.
What is actually very interesting about the colonial project, and you know, in many ways, anthropology develops under the umbrella of imperialism, of colonialism, is the exploration of the other, the exploration of the culture of the other, and a very disciplined description of the way others think. Perhaps from the standpoint of the imperializing, you know, Western power, but it still was a recognition for one of difference. Mm-hmm. And in different colonial contexts, that worked out differently. It wasn't always a question of imposing your will, your values on communities that you had colonized. Sometimes it was in saying, well, actually, they're at a lower stage of development, and a paternalistic attitude develops between colonial powers and the other that is different. These were, in fact, there's a range of responses, I think, of colonial powers to culturally different others.
I think, and that's a great point. And I think we should note the two different, well, two out of many different layers of the colonial project. On one hand, the political layer, which clearly wanted to ensure that things benefited the colonial center. But at the same time, there were all these interesting academic endeavors. And one controversial byproduct of that is Orientalism, where you see the flourishing of both, you know, high credible philology, but at the same time, academic endeavors that attempted to document and observe the ways of lives of the natives in order to feed information to the bureaucrats, the colonial bureaucrats are running. So you're right, there is this contradiction in the colonial period that on one hand, there was perhaps a universal thrust behind the colonial endeavor, but at the same time, in order for that to be effective, they had to adopt a more relativist position, as you said so.
But, you know, what's also fascinating about that process, whether it was for kind of counterinsurgency reasons, like we're going to learn how they think in order to control them better. But there was also this other thing that was happening. It kind of fixed local cultures. It fixed the culture of the other as if they were always and somehow undynamic. Those local cultures didn't change. And I think one of the things that we might explore in the problems of cultural relativism is that it needs to kind of define a culture. And it often fixes it, has a boundary drawn around it as if it didn't change.
Objectifies it.
Yeah, it objectifies. So maybe at this point we can actually begin to talk about what is problematic about a cultural relativist position. I mean, broadly, you've outlined what is appealing about it, mm-hmm. but what is problematic about it?
Okay, the first problem, and Rachel talks about this, is that if we take the cultural relativist position, we could no longer say that the customs of other societies are morally inferior to our own. Right now, the immediate obvious question would be, why is that important? Why is it important for us to say that other cultures are more inferior or superior to us, right? We can answer this by giving an example. A culture with anti-Semitism is worse than a culture without anti-Semitism. Similarly, a culture with slavery is worse than a culture without slavery.
Is that an assertion or is it a...
No, I'm just giving an example.
Okay. Right?
Example by way of two assertions, right? Now, if you were to take the cultural relativist logic, you would have to get into an argument for why anti-Semitism and slavery can possibly be desirable for a culture. But that would be a little bit absurd, right? So the universalist position would say that cultural relativist positions cannot account for certain moral imperatives that we would need for society to improve. And one clear example of that imperative would be the statement or the belief that slavery is wrong, right? So, and I think some time has passed over the past 200 years for us to see that it clearly is wrong. So a cultural relativist position, however well-meaning, would not be able to make that claim.
Now, you know, we have had in the past certain practices that were meaningful for people, right? So say, for instance, the practice of sati, right? Where a Hindu bride kills herself on the funeral pyre of her husband. So her husband dies, she dies along with it. Or practices where, you know, women might go into basically a kind of negation of their personhood after the death of their spouses, their male spouses.
Now, can you explain the negation of the personhood?
Well, basically, you know, you withdraw from the world. You're only allowed to wear a certain color. You know, you're not seen in public. And these are kind of old world practices or practices from a particular time. And we now see that as negative. And in like you use the word absurd, right? But it might not have been absurd for the people who practiced it. And I think maybe with the cultural relativists, they're also recognizing that the experience of those moral landscapes by those individuals in that time or in those cultures is probably also meaningful, that we can't just impose an assessment from outside, you know, looking back now and say, oh, yes, of course, it was absurd that women should do this. But, you know, maybe if you wrenched that woman at that time out of this practice, she would have felt the kind of cultural death. I mean, if she had been brought up to believe that this was the right thing to do, this was going to be meaningful, you know, she might not have recognized her liberation as liberation, as it were.
I see the virtue behind that move, I think. However, what the universalists would say is that cultures are not static and cultures are not always uniform. Granted, there are people who cherish those practices, who feel that their lives are given meaning by witnessing, being a part of, or participating in those practices. But I think it would be sensible to also grant that at any given time, there were people who felt that it was wrong, or that there was always a debate on the extent to which those practices are legitimate. And in that, we can recognize that culture is dynamic, that it's fluid, there are a lot of competing voices, and that to just simply assume that there was a uniform consensus in that culture that rendered that practice valuable for everybody would be somewhat obscuring the more complex picture of cultures. There's always dissension, there's always debate, there's always dialogue, there's always evolution of these practices. If not in the how their practices are executed, in how the practices are interpreted. Also, the second reason for why cultural relativism is a problem, according to Rachels in this book, is that it would call the idea of moral progress into doubt. I think it's fair to say that we're all always looking to better ourselves in one way or another. We might have different disagreements on what would constitute what's better or what's worse, but the impulse to constantly pursue the good is always there. And this is always resting on some assumption of a moral foundation behind our actions. And to take a cultural relativist position would either ignore that or call the very idea of the fact that we can continually better ourselves as a society into question. And for Rachel's, and I think I'm inclined to agree here, that would not allow for meaningful progress in a society, you know. So the idea that we can always improve ourselves requires some commitment to foundational values, however thin they may be.
Now, for some societies, values do not come out of some explicit social and political negotiation. They come from some mystical origin. They come from God. They come from the gods, you know. So in that situation, in the latter situation, how do you deal with change? How do you deal with the decision that's made at some point in history in the 20th century that we needed a universal declaration on human rights? We need to establish some minimal standard of human rights across the world, regardless of cultural difference. People will say, yes, but this was, you know, done in 1945 or whatever it was. But my God is slightly older than that. And what he or she told me was, this is how I should live my life.
We actually got this, we had the same type of debate not too long ago among the Muslim groups here, right, about whether or not human rights is Islamic. And if you look at Islamic history, the reason why we even had a golden age was because there was a lot of disagreements on... Well, among other things, theological disagreements, but also disagreements on the relationship between scripture and ethics. So you're right. Even there are issues when you have a different kind of ethical assumptions functioning in your worldview. In this case, it's religion. But even that is not static. There's always disagreement. There's always debates. There are always questions being posed. And in that, you always find some variety of ethical outlooks, even at the margins. And now to bring back to the issue of human rights, you see now that there are more progressive people of religious persuasion who are trying to connect their scriptural tradition with the broader discourse of human rights. In Malaysia, for example, you have Islamic Renaissance Front, which are trying to do that. And you have groups like... Ilmu, for example, who are clearly against human rights because it's supposedly, we're told, against Islam. So there's that spectrum of opinions.
Well, it's also very interesting the way in which people think through that, their objection to universalism, as it were. You know, in 1993, there was a World Conference on Human Rights in Vienna, and a leading intellectual from Malaysia, Chandra Muzaffar, put up an argument that there was a distinction to be made between Western values and Asian values. And he used the question of LGBT rights, gay rights, as a way of marking that border between Western and Asian values. Now, the Asian values debate is a very big one. It was sponsored by Lee Kuan Yew in Singapore and his so-called Singapore School.
And it's sponsored by Mahathir here.
And it's sponsored by Mahathir here. It's sponsored by many people who for whom it was very opportune to use that distinction, that, you know, in order to insulate themselves from a certain type of criticism. And I wonder if that kind of argumentation falls in under the category of a more sophisticated form of relativism that, you know, you kind of talked about at the start of this discussion. Mm-hmm. You said, you know, you hope your undergraduates, if they're going to hang on to the relativism, at least hang on to a sophisticated form. Is this a sophisticated form of relativism?
It depends. Insofar as we've heard people like Lee Kuan Yew espouse a kind of Asian values to replace human rights, I would think that much more work needs to be done to flesh that out. But let's be real here. I mean, human rights... is only a recent construction. And even the philosophical foundations of human rights is recent. If we can look back to the Glorious Revolution, the French Revolution, these things didn't happen overnight. It was crystallized through trial and error over centuries, over reflections about political tragedy that made human rights more valuable today. So it wasn't a natural process, even though the idiom that is used to explain it assumes a lot about universal human nature or inalienable rights, right? So human rights is culturally specific. So it's clearly different than, for example, Islamic ethics. It's also clearly different from, for sake of argument, let's call it Asian values. The question here is, are these differences incommensurable? Do they necessarily mean that all these things are incompatible, right? So I would say that they're not. There are differences, but there are also points of convergence. And I think the more sophisticated task that we can take on, while maintaining some affinity to relativism is to see that, right? Where the differences happen, but where there's also still hope for bonds to be built despite those differences. So we can still prize differences, we can still prize individual autonomy of different cultures, but I think the larger task that we need now is to find the bridges that can be built across these different ethical values.
I mean, one of the things that comes out of this attempt to build bridges, obviously, is the Universal Declaration. But how it's operationalized, how institutions like the UN push that agenda, I think is quite instructive. I spoke to Frank LaRue, who is the UN Special Rapporteur on the Promotion and Protection of Right to Freedom of Opinion and Expression some a year or so ago. And what he said very clearly to me was that the UN Declaration of Human Rights is a minimal standard. It doesn't seek to transform all cultures and make them homogenous. But what it does say is that you cannot violate these principles by using culture as a kind of excuse. And that struck me as very interesting because it's an attempt to define universalism as a minimum standard, not as some sort of totalizing vision of how we all should be.
Mm-hmm. I would be inclined to agree with everything that Frank LaRue said there. Is this that what is minimal? It also depends on the eye of the beholder. You know, for a conservative Muslim who wants to take everything the Quran says literally, the claims of human rights are not minimal because they appeal to a certain type of personhood. Given the way things are, that's minimal enough. It can't be more minimal than that. But the dialogue has to continue. And I think the key thing to take home from this brief tour of the cultural relativism debate is that the dialogue has to continue because not everybody will be happy. If we really want to be respectful of differences, we will have to leave the door open for disagreements. But the key thing is not to think that differences solve the problem, or not to think that by having differences, then we are necessarily making things better, right? There's certain heinous things like slavery that we should not tolerate based on an argument for cultural relativism. So the task of dialogue is to ensure that we see the common bonds in that process, and hopefully we learn to appreciate each other's differences because we're actually being exposed to it more.
Now, speaking about dialogue, talking about reading and helping that dialogue be informed, you've got recommendations for
us? I have two texts to recommend. The first is an article by Alison Jagger called Globalizing Feminist Ethics. It's from 1998, so it's been a while since it was released, but I still think it's very valuable because it really talks about how women from different cultural contexts can nonetheless come together to forge a common feminist ideal in light of globalization. So that's the first book. The second one is Multiculturalism, Examining the Politics of Recognition. It's an anthology of essays edited by Amy Gutman. And it basically talks about the tensions between personal and collective identity and how we can still have universalism in a world of difference. So these two texts are good starting points for you. Both are, I think, pretty easily accessible. They're not very academic, given how dense academic texts can go. So the Alison Jagger's essay and the anthology of essays by Amy Goodman, featuring Charles Taylor, Kwame Appiah, and Michael Walzer, among others, are good starting points.
Okay, so we have to close the discussion at this point. We could get more stuff on Facebook.
Those comments coming. We'd love to hear it for you.
Yeah, so remember, it's BFM Night School on Facebook, and you can also email us at bfmnightschool@gmail.com. Mm-hmm. I'm also on Twitter at Sharad Kutan. Fuad, are you on Twitter yet?
Not yet.
No,
yeah, I should
okay.
Get to that.
Yeah. Okay. Too many things on your plate. Too many important things. Anyway, so Night School comes to a close. Thank you very much for joining us. Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, myself, Sharad Kutan. This is Night School on BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9. The Business Station.